Blog Talk Radio.
Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist, and you'll find us online at speculist.com. That's speculist.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we are all about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities which lie at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are difficult to predict, sometimes even difficult to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead and that will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I'm super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
I am doing very well. I hope you are having a great International Jugglers Day.
you know what? With so much going on in my life, I failed to even make note of the fact that today was International Jugglers Day. So,
oh, well, I don't know how you
thank you for that timely reminder.
I came across this calendar, and apparently every single day of the year is like five different holidays, if you know where to look. And today I picked out the funniest one. Tomorrow, by the way, is National High Five Day. So I intend to...
Okay, I'm celebrating that one.
Oh, yeah, I'm all about High Five Day, so.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad that you reminded me about that one, because that's important. It's not like Juggler's Day, you know, which used to be really nice, and then it got all commercialized, you know.
And exactly. Yeah, all these,
it's
all
not
these
like
clowns
when we were kids.
Running around, you know, messing up.
It messing up. Really means something, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
So speaking of unusual odd holidays. We passed Yuri's Night on Friday, I believe, of last week. Did you commemorate in any way?
Well, I actually did mention it to my kids. I said, you know, this is the day. You know, that mankind made it to the outer space for the first time. And you know, I think it's a good healthy thing that people worldwide are beginning to recognize this. I mean, it was. You know, it was a sad day in this country for many, many years. But you know, we can get past that. You know, we can celebrate the fact that mankind made it to outer space.
Yeah, I think we have the perspective now that we can look back on that day and we can go, well, that's the day. You know, this like the second in a series of humiliations that we the U.S. suffered at the hands of the Soviets in space. And, it was hard. I mean, you know, first with Sputnik and then with Gagarin, and they continued to beat us in space for a while after that. Some might even say that we never really caught up in the space race until we won it by landing on the moon. But however you score it, we were definitely way behind at that point, weren't we?
Yeah.
And it's interesting to note that that was a hard day. That was a big blow to the U.S. But also, along with Sputnik, probably what inspired and made Apollo possible. If you take the right perspective, it's how we got to the moon was by Yuri Gagarin going into space. Had the first human being in space been an American, I wonder if we'd still even have been to the moon yet.
I don't know. It's there could have potentially still been a space race, and who knows how, you know, it has shaked out. The fact that we were behind, I think, actually helped us win the race. I mean, it put a fire under us. And you know, and reading the book, it's like a movie in my head. I picture it.
Absolutely.
It's such a good book. Reading the book Rocket Man, I found it fascinating that you know the Soviets had on their launch pad a a ship, a rocket to go to the moon if Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin were unsuccessful. And the thing is that they had they calculated that their chances of doing it and bringing back home live cosmonauts were pretty long. Their chances.
Yeah.
And so here's their thought: if they're unsuccessful, it won't look so bad if we're unsuccessful too. It'll look like
right.
it's kind of a tie. You know, we're
right.
you know. And if we happen to be successful, if we get lucky, and we we've won the space race, and there you go. So they just they sat back and watched, and just wondered whether we would be successful. And when we were, then they canceled that mission. So.
And what did you say they calculated the odds of their getting there safely?
Well, I don't think it's said in the book. I had read someplace else that they calculated their odds as like 1 in 3.
Yeah,
because the
rocket that they were going to use, the one other time that they had tried to use one of those, it had blown up on the pad and killed like, I don't know, a couple hundred people on the ground or something like that. It was just a complete disaster. So they were truly putting it out there had they launched that in pursuit of that goal. It must have been, I mean, as sad as they were to lose the space race, must have been kind of a huge relief for them, actually, for the U.S. program to have worked out, you know, because I think 1 in 3 was giving them pretty favorable odds, actually, on that thing.
Well, I don't know if, you know, I would say this. Cosmonaut wives and children were probably relieved.
Yeah. No. Well, exactly. Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point. And people on the ground, you know, like ground crew type people, they were probably pretty relieved.
Did you get a chance to actually watch the space shuttle come in?
No, I didn't.
I watched some of the live feed of it landing in Washington D.C. You know, kind of the end of an era kind of thing, and. Again, visiting with my kids, like I do about these things, they, you know, expressed a little sadness about it. And so, you know, what I had to do was load up the SpaceX videos and watch it with them. These guys at SpaceX are just incredibly impressive to me. Just a few years ago, anybody talking about private space ventures, it was halfway a joke. These guys are no joke. You know, they... the more I learn about them, the more serious it appears that they are, and they're launching. If all goes well, they're set to launch April the 30th to send an unmanned capsule to the International Space Station with relief supplies. They've got one orbital shot under their belt, and this will be their second orbital mission. And that's pretty impressive to get to the International Space Station on their second mission if they pull it off. So, wishing those guys luck.
Absolutely. Well, it's going to be really interesting to watch SpaceX as it develops, to see if they kind of slowly and subtly become the way we get into space, taking on a supply mission for the International Space Station is a great start. I'm looking forward to seeing them be the carrier of choice for getting people into orbit. I think that's going to be a huge step when that happens. And I do say when, because I thoroughly expect that to happen. In the not too distant future. I can only imagine that'll be a fairly quick transition, and that they won't be the only player either. That we'll be seeing multiple players coming into the space. It's really exciting to see and interesting that you make that point in light of the discussion, the remembrance of Yuri's night. We got into space through big government programs, both Soviet and American programs, and there are other countries that have had space programs or that are even now talking about developing programs. China's got an interesting space program they've got going. India's been making moves in that direction. So there's been this whole arc of big government programs that propel people into space. And now we've got something new emerging, and it's very exciting, which is private space development. There's still going to be some interplay. There's still going to be interaction with government, but I really think the field opens up in an exciting way, in a very different way, with SpaceX and some of these other players coming online. It's going to be really interesting to watch.
Other players. Today, I learned of a new player, Planetary Resources. It's a new company being launched by Google co-founders Larry Page, Eric Schmidt, filmmaker James Cameron, former Microsoft big guy Charles. Is it Simonyi? Simonyi?
Not sure how to pronounce that.
Yeah, one of the original Microsoft guys. And then Ross Perot Jr., the son of the former presidential candidate, all of their money, launching a company called Planetary Resources, and in their announcement they're saying the company will overlay two critical sectors, space exploration and natural resources, to add trillions of dollars to the global GDP. This innovative startup will create a new industry and a new definition of natural resources.
Actually, I just before dialing into the show, saw on Facebook, Christine Peterson was speculating or repeating speculation that this might be an asteroid mining venture that's being started here.
Right. It could be that they're talking about the moon. It could be they're talking about asteroids. But they're obviously they're talking about getting stuff from somewhere. I think that's a pretty. I think it's either going back to the moon or going to the asteroid belt. And asteroid belt might be easier. You don't have to break away from from gravity to get home. It's further away, but it might be easier to mine those than the moon. But I think they're definitely hinting at that, it seems, in this announcement. So that's pretty cool. That's pretty cool. Now, if they get there on their own rockets, or if they hire SpaceX and they're like the company that does the mining once they get there. I'm not sure exactly what Planetary Resources will be, but yeah, this is just again, this is a field that seems to be attracting big money and big resources all of a sudden. And I think part of it is that SpaceX has demonstrated an ability to launch at one tenth the price of NASA. And once you're able to get a lot of stuff up there cheaply, then all of a sudden it begins to look real to people, and they begin punching their calculators and realizing, hey, we could possibly make money doing this. And to me, that's exciting.
I think it's really exciting. It goes to show you that there is recognition of the commercial potential of space, and what has been needed all along is a push from the private sector to get people seriously thinking about how they can exploit that potential, or I don't know, exploit is a bad word, leverage that potential, how they can make use of that economic potential, because it's there. We know it's there. There's energy in space. There are natural resources in space. There's a lot of room up there. That's why they call it space, as Carl Sagan once said on the Tonight Show. I thought it was a great great line. There's a lot of value out in space, and the problem up to this point has been getting there. It's such an expensive proposition to get there, and it's an expensive proposition to be there for any period of time, and it's an expensive proposition to get back, which goes to your point about if you go to the moon, you're in that big gravity well, and so it's like you're not only having to fly a ship there, then you've got to break out of that gravity well to come back. Not nearly as big as Earth or like if you went to Mars or something like that, but still it's a substantial issue. Whereas if you go to the asteroids, you're just out. You're out in space. You're weightless the whole time. Of course, there's trade-offs there. If you go to the moon, it's like you can have a base, right? You can operate in some ways like more or less normal life or something closer to normal life than you would have just kind of floating around amongst the asteroids. But the point is the big challenge has always been getting there. And the big challenge in getting there is not just technological, it's economic. And it's been something that only big nation states, at one time only the two big superpowers in the world, the two biggest powers in the world, could even think about taking on. And that equation has changed. And I think we'll see that that changes everything.
Absolutely. Over at Next Big Future, he was talking about our friend Brian Wong posted something a couple of days ago. It's a Journal of Aerospace Engineering. published a scholarly article on the subject of affordable rapid bootstrapping of the space and space industry. And the idea is this, that advances in robotics and additive manufacturing have become a game changer for the prospects of space industry. These guys, you know, again, they pull out their calculators and they punch the numbers. They say that with as few as 12 metric tons of equipment put on the moon, you could have a self-sustaining, robotically, it wouldn't be manned by anybody. You wouldn't have people on the moon with their oxygen and food requirements and everything else. You just have robots, and they build what they need. They live off the land, in other words. And with as few as 12 metric tons, it would be self-sustaining and growing. You could grow an industry on the moon. I think that's pretty exciting.
With how much stuff?
12
metric tons?
Yeah, now they say.
Now that's a bit. That's a lot of stuff to move to the moon, but still.
But it's not that much. I mean, a few launches and you got it done. Now they say you could get it done a lot faster. They ran the numbers of up to 40 metric tons. Yeah. Mm-hmm. If you were able to put that much equipment on the moon, then your prospects, improve and your ability to get it done quicker, go up. So, I think that's just an interesting thing there. And these sorts of studies and our ability to do these things robotically and remotely have changed the outlook of space to the point that it's not a joke any longer.
That's really amazing. And just to make sure I've got the concept down, what they're saying is that's enough stuff that you can bootstrap everything else you need.
That's right. You basically what you take is a bunch of robots, solar panels, and 3D printers that use the material that on the moon to build other structures, build what they need, and they're often going with 12
yeah.
metric tons.
It's still huge by nanotechnology standards, right? What we should really be able to send up is like 1 pound of stuff, right? And it should
a Coke can work, and
yeah,
it ought
exactly.
to be able to go. But we're not there yet, so we'll send a lot more stuff apparently.
Oh, you know what? I've got I'm gonna just go on hold just for a minute. I believe our guest is calling me on my mobile phone, so hang on just a second.
Okay. All right. We had had a little bit of trouble. We had scheduled for tonight John Smart, the futurist John Smart, and we're very excited about getting him on the show, and we're having a little trouble getting in touch with him before the show as we intended. So hopefully we can get him on the show. I will buzz him here in just a second. Just, in addition to the I guess I'll just add a little more space stuff. Stratolaunch, the world's largest plane. SpaceX is building it. It is made from 2 747s. And much like the White Knight launch spaceship 1, that was a relatively small plane. This thing with the 2 747s would launch a SpaceX capsule aircraft from high up. And save a lot of rocket fuel that way and be cheaper. All right.
Stephen, can you let me back on?
Yeah, are you there? Okay.
Yes. Sorry about that. I, I, I attempted to unmute my line and I hit the wrong button.
Okay, you're back.
Hey there, guys.
You're back. Okay, and there's John Smart. How you doing, John?
Oh, I'm doing great. Stephen, how you doing?
Excellent, excellent.
We have a tradition on Fast Forward Radio, which is we try to have at least one good technical glitch with each show. So I feel like we've more than covered our ground here, but that's okay. Stephen and I were talking a little space. We were commemorating Yuri's night and talking about SpaceX and some interesting developments coming along the pipe. But I had a feeling we'd catch up with you eventually. And let me just tell our listeners that we're very pleased to welcome our special guest, John Smart, who's in Colorado this week. He's going to be speaking at the Da Vinci Institute tomorrow night. So I'm really looking forward to driving up there and listening as John shares with that group. John, always a pleasure having you on the program. Of course, you are one of our key inspirations for this program and have been a participant in both installments of The World Transformed. Great always to have you with us.
Oh, thank you so much, Phil. Yeah, it's an honor to be able to drop in and chat with you guys, and this is my first time out to Denver. I'm really excited both to be visiting the Da Vinci Institute, which is really doing some neat futuring work, and also to be seeing you tomorrow, and to be able to drop in on this Fast Forward Radio tonight, and maybe talk about a few of the areas of technological change that I'll be talking to Da Vinci about tomorrow.
That'd be great. Hey, you know, our plan was to work through this list of 10 drivers of technology, these 10 big changes, and I think we've got about 40 minutes, so we'll do that in a highlight kind of way. But before we do that, maybe you can just give us a quick rundown on what the Da Vinci Institute is and how you came to be connected with them.
Well, Thomas Frey runs it, and he's been doing it for looks like about 15 years, I guess, and he is one of the foremost futurist speakers around the world. I think he's one of the top ranked ones in Google, and he speaks to various conventions and industry groups about the future of various things, world traveler, kind of a, what we call a professional futurist or foresight professional, more on the speaking end, but he also has this consulting group at Da Vinci Institute, and he's a bit of an entrepreneur. He's just launched what he calls Code Academy here at the Da Vinci Institute, which is education, kind of a cheaper way of learning Ruby on Rails and things like that than, say, going to DeVry or one of these other institutes or getting a computer science degree. It's part of this new model of uncertified entrepreneurial, I guess you could call them academies, that will very quickly get you up to speed and the critical skills you need for the new economy, you know, digital skills. And so he's focusing in on coding. And so those are probably his three main activities, the consulting, the speaking, and now this entrepreneurial thing. And then actually, there's a fourth thing. He runs a innovators workshop. Or sorry, innovators, not a workshop, an innovators kind of an expo once a year. It's one of the biggest in the country. I think it's like the third biggest now, something like that. And it's basically a place for a bunch of people who have different inventions to get together and kind of present them to folks who might be interested in buying them or helping them, venture capitalists, help them develop them, that kind of thing. So those are kind of his interests. And it's fun to chat with a guy like this because he, you know, seen enough stuff being in the foresight space as long as he has that he's kind of got an interesting opinion or he's heard something interesting in just about every area you could imagine. So good guy to know. And it's fun to hear what's on his radar and what things he's, you know, excited about right now. We were just having a riff at dinner here about teacherless education. this whole post institutional paradigm of education, you know, what's it going to look like in 5 years and 10 years? And that's one of the areas that I talk about in my kind of 10 areas of technology change. So I was giving him my thoughts on it and hearing his, and it's a lot of fun because I think we're going to see some major disruption in the education space, you know, just very, very soon from now. We're starting to see it, but really, really see it when these social networks and these the bandwidth gets a little bit better, and the platforms, gamification of systems gets better, and the conversational interface, probably the most important thing, comes because people will be able to learn.
That's the piece that's going to get you into a teacherless environment, right? I mean, if there really ever is going to be such a thing, because then you're interacting with the machine the way you would interact with a human being. I know that the conversational user interface is one of your it's an important coming technology that I've heard you talk about before, and it seems like we're getting closer and closer to it now. It's really interesting to see this unfolding and start to recognize
before that too, though, a little bit. Think of peer to peer education, for example. So you know the hole in the wall, the guy that has the Hole in the Wall Education Foundation, where he puts computers out in slums with no instruction, and the kids kind of teach themselves how to use the web.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
So I forget his name, but go to holeinthewall.org, and you'll find all the initiatives that he does in that space. And what they've discovered is you just get four kids around a laptop, and they'll teach each other. And so there's a lot of that potential coming even before the conversational interface, when the networks are there, when the one smartphone per child model that we're talking about, when the connectivity gets cheap enough and the actual devices get cheap enough, there's a whole lot of that can happen that's also pretty teacherless. It's just kind of peer-based. But I think you're right. I think the conversation interface blows it open, and we're right on the edge of that happening. In fact, I have some interesting news about that I could share tonight when we get around
to it. We're gonna have to jump into that. I remember when I saw the first ad I saw for Siri. A couple years ago now, or a concept or something. Maybe it was prior even to there being an ad for it. But when I first heard about it, first saw it in action, I was like, aha, here it comes. we're closing in on this thing. It's pretty amazing. So it's great that you're gonna be talking at Da Vinci Institute. One comment about that, because I've been following Thomas Frey on the web for quite some time. Never actually met him, so I'm looking forward to meeting him tomorrow, having lived in the same metro area with him all these years and haven't made it to any of his events. But for quite some time, and I want to say this in a way that it doesn't sound anything other than just descriptive. It's not in any way disparaging. But I always thought of him as kind of standard futurist, and I don't mean that in a bad way, but I just mean kind of like there's been this kind of core of futurist thinking for quite a while, and then I've got my friends who are like you, right? There's the Kurzweils of the world. There's this kind of recognition of this sweeping new change, this kind of new approach to the future that has come online over the last few years. So I think it's really exciting to see him inviting you to talk at his event. To me, that shows how far we've come, that the regular futurist community, I don't know the right, the conventional futurist community, the standard one, is beginning to recognize the importance of the work that you do. And I think that's really exciting.
Yeah. When you think about what he does, and, he's talking about the future to all these different industry groups. And as you say, he's giving a lot of the standard, kind of background and sets of issues to them, but he's also going to the cutting edge too, after establishing his credentials in the general kind of speaking industry manner, where he's going to entertain, he's going to provoke, he's going to give you some touchstones, you know, for common things that everyone in the room can understand, and then he's going to, you know, stretch your mind a little bit. And I think that's really important that we have futurists that do that, and that's probably the bread and butter of futurism, or foresight, the foresight profession, as I like to call it.
Mm-hmm.
Because most people aren't really ready to have their mind warped. Most people aren't out in the transhumanist frontier like we are. And the more that we have people kind of circling around it and thinking of the conventional futures and how, you know, these issues relate to their strategic plans for the next, you know, quarter, year, 3 years, and then doing a little bit of longer-term thinking, the bigger the space and the more opportunity for those of us who like looking at the levers of the world, if you will, the things that are moving the fastest and that are really going to disrupt everything, you know, massively as we go forward because they're exponential. We have more room to manipulate, or more room to maneuver, and more business comes to us because we're better associated with, as you call them, the conventional futurists, the bread and butter futurists that you know, are part of the National Association of Speakers, going around, you know, folks like Glenn Heemstra and Tom Frey and Patrick Dixon. If you've ever been to Pat Dixon's website, you know, he's got 29 million people that have viewed his, or 29 million views on his YouTube channel. You know, this is important stuff. You want to start.
Absolutely.
You want to start with that, and then you get to go Kurzweil on him, or now we can say go Diamandis on him, because abundance is just a brilliant repackaging of these harder core ideas in a way that's very accessibly written, very easy to read that book. You will just... you'll snarf that book up. It's one of the easiest books I've ever read, and yet it's one of the most, one of the best packaging of these accelerative memes. So, Diamandis and Kotler have done a great job. Really, it's the book that everybody should read right now. That you know, it stands on the shoulders of the Rational Optimist. And
absolutely, yeah. I was going to say, 2 years ago we were pushing the Rational Optimist. The last few weeks we've been talking abundance on this program. I think Stephen, you and I both probably read that in about a weekend each, right?
Two sittings for me.
There you go.
I just completely ran out of steam at about 4 a.m. on the first sitting, got about 4 hours of rest, got up and read the rest.
Stephen, I want to know, are you going to read it again? Are you going to read it a second time?
Oh, yeah. I've referred to it. Now, and the way I read it was, of course, on the Kindle, and as I made my notes, see, thanks to that, I can, you know, pull up the notes during the middle of the show and talk about it that way.
There you go,
we
talked about the show. Stephen already had an outline done from his Kindle notes, and of course he's tweeting the whole time he's reading it too. So it's really amazing interactive age of reading.
You pretty
much blogged the book. They're going to sue you, I think. Actually, I think you repeated too much of
the book. If they don't make a documentary out of that, that's a crying shame, because
they should.
That book is crying out for an abundance documentary, and hopefully Peter will. You know, he's a very savvy guy, and hopefully
You know what's amazing to me about that, John, is that he didn't spend a third of the book tooting his own whistle over all the accomplishments he has.
Yeah.
You know, he barely mentioned some of the great, cool, and interesting things that he has done to contribute to this, you know, abundant world. He mentioned incentive prizes, and he talked about, you know, his experience with that just a little bit.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that was just a very small part of this huge portrait he was painting with the book. And yeah, I got to agree. Just an excellent book.
It really shows you, you know, how savvy our better futurists are getting, right? They're taking their egos out of it, and they're they're putting the ideas out there, but more importantly, they're putting them out in a way that requires minimum cognitive overhead for you and I to grab them. That book is the hooks, the way they hook you, and the way they write things, and the things that he leaves out, he and Kotler leave out, are just as important as the things they're putting in. They're stating things in as simple a way as possible without misstating them. You know, you can read that book the first time for the interesting ideas. You're going to read it the second time for the way that he's written it. You're just going to really appreciate it. It's kind of
even our politicians might understand it. You know,
yeah, I agree with you. I agree with you. Yeah, whether they'd be able to do anything about it, that's a different story, but at least they'd understand it.
as long as their handlers can, I think that's the real key. Well,
yeah,
I'm
of the opinion that politics is going to change the least over the next 20 years. It's one of those spaces that's not accelerative at the moment, and except for in local. You know, there's going to be a lot of really cool local stuff that will happen, and it'll all be driven by these social networks. And we'll see, you know, the accelerative changes that happen on the social, educational, economic, all the technology sides are going to eventually drive changes in the political side. But, I think very, very often the big lesson that we can help, our Foresight community understand is, you don't want to spend too much time thinking about the politics and stuff because you really aren't going to be able to influence it. It's a game that's rigged so that you can't win right now. You can't get a viable third party because there's no ranked choice voting allowed. So what you can do is you can push for ranked choice voting at the state level. And that has happened in several states now. And then those states now, for the first time, can finally get viable third parties, and then you can finally get real choice available to people. And term limits have actually worked at the state level. Eventually we'll get them at the federal level, but all that stuff's probably going to take 15-20 years. In the meantime, we'll get better and better understanding of how we need to run our country by what Alice Bridges calls the totally quantified society, where the web, big data gets good enough that we just see how much better these alternative forms of democracy work than ours. You know, for example, parliamentary democracy, how much better it is. Nobody uses the American U.S. Constitution anymore for starting states. I think it was tried 15 different times so far, and in all but Costa Rica, those countries collapsed into dictatorship within 10 to 20 years. Because a parliamentary democracy is truly much more democratic and much more balanced than our form of democracy, because you can't – the legislature can vote no confidence on the executive. And when you have that check, the executive can't turn into a cowboy that just gets more and more power centralized. And, with simple reforms like that the Canadian democracy and the South African democracy, believe it or not, ironically, right? The way these systems are structured, the old people that do democracy studies think that these are just far better versions of the codes because, they're taking our stuff and adding to it and doing a better job. We had a wonderful democracy for 200 years ago, but until we're willing to get beyond our reverence, our irrational reverence for the code, and do what Jefferson said, go back and see if it needs to be adjusted every generation, we're going to be stuck with something that isn't cutting edge. And so it's very easy to see, like the latest New York Times article talked about how, all these new democracies around the world, they're using the Canadian and the South African one. They don't use ours anymore because – anybody with any, reasonable history can look and see, just how bad, just how easily ours gets captured by and turned into, the presidency turns into a dictatorship because there just aren't enough checks and balances in the one that we have. And but will we change it over the next 20 years? No. So we can focus on the things that really are accelerative, and we can spend, not too much time getting worried about, these major imbalances that
cool.
we have.
Cool. Let's talk about some of that stuff then. Let's we eschew politics on this program pretty regularly anyhow. So let's
do you? Okay, good.
Yeah, we'll switch it over and talk about the. Let's talk about the 10 items on this list. Now, before we jump into this, something, Stephen, I was supposed to say at the beginning of the program, and I don't think you heard this, and I know no one listening did, so I'm sorry. I was supposed to tell everyone. Sally's not here this evening, so we got no chat host in the chat room. She's doing her move from Arizona back to, where does she live, Minnesota this week. And next, and so she won't be around this week or next week. So I am appointing, I think Thuris and Ken, and okay, well you two, you guys are chat hosts now, so you've been formally deputized. If anyone has a question for John, just keep the conversation going and push him that way. And Stephen, I just wanted to note in passing, have you noticed this too? Anytime Kurzweil or John Smart is on the show, Sally's not around.
I don't think that's on purpose. I think she likes John Smart as much as the rest of it.
No, she definitely does. I think there's something very suspicious here. I think she's a puppet master or something like that.
Yeah.
I don't know what's going on. But whenever we get the big guns out, Sally disappears. I'm not sure what's going on.
I've never seen Sally and John in the same room at the same time.
That's all I'm saying. Okay, that's my point. It's just very odd. Okay, so John, we got 10 items on this list. We can, with the time we have left, treat each to about a minute and a half. Is there a sound bite you can give us on each of those that would be worth doing, or should we just casually stroll through?
Let's do the 64,000 foot tour of them, and then see if any folks in the chat community have specific questions and topics that they, you know, concerns, issues they have around any of these technologies, and then we can talk about those for the rest of it. So the first one is nanoscience and technologies. And, you know, the soundbite takeaway is the nanospace is orders of magnitude faster, stronger, and efficient than human space. We don't recognize it yet. We don't fund it yet enough. We spend maybe $3 billion a year on basic nanoscience R&D. And it totally pays for itself so vastly more than any other R&D we spend. And we don't recognize that that's really the nanospace is what's driving all the accelerating change on the physical side. And I hope we will. So things like small-scale physics, fission, fusion, nanochemistry, nanocomputing, nanodevices, that's all nanoscience and technologies. And it's the physical driver of accelerating change. So that's technology one. Technology two is resource technologies. And these are things like energy, water, food, population, which is a resource, a human population. Julian Simon called it the ultimate resource, and ecosystem and other resources. And next-gen technology, enterprise, and policy is going to solve all of our grand challenges in these areas like energy, water, and food, population, and ecosystem degradation. But I think it only does so under stress. We don't change as humans when we see the light. We change when we feel the heat, unfortunately. And so, you know, we have to wait for some of these catastrophes, but we have the ability to fix them when we get into them. So hopefully we'll get smarter at being proactive and not being so reactive. But I'm not sure that's going to happen at the level that we'd like. Third technology is engineering technologies. And those are things like smart cities, green tech, pollution control, transportation, logistics, manufacturing automation and robotics, and dematerialization and efficiency. So dematerialization is where we learn how to substitute digital products and processes for physical ones. You know, think of telepresence versus physical travel, or all the physical products that an iPhone or your intelligent household robot are going to replace. We're dematerializing the more advanced our technology gets. We don't need so much physical stuff because we have more multi-purpose capacities in our digital and robotic technologies. So that one's going to keep rolling, and I think making smart, networked, virtualized, secure, productive, sustainable urban space is the key to every country's future, because 50% of us now live in cities. It's going to be 60% by 2025, and either 70 or 80% by 2040. It's really cities, depending on how well they solve their problems of crime, gridlock, pollution, slums, they're going to grow fast or extremely fast in coming years because they're just so much more productive per capita and efficient to live for us all to live close to each other with our smart networks giving us incredible sets of social and business opportunities that are just steps away from each other. The fourth big technology that I think we need to think about is information technologies. And these are things like all the levels of computing, from supercomputing all the way down to mobile and wearable. It's eyeglasses and Apple's eyeglasses and Google glasses coming, end of this year. Communication and networks, big data, maps and algorithms, agents, and the conversational interface and cyber twin that we talked about. Siri,
Kim in the chat room, John, Kim in the chat room is asking about augmented reality. Is that going to be an important part of that?
Yes, I think that's a huge part of it. I actually put augmented reality in the social technology space. I don't consider it a pure technology because augmented reality is actually we're overlaying this digital stuff onto all of our social interactions and on our physical interactions. So, everyone has a different place that they put these things, but I think it's going to be huge, these, like I said, the eyeglasses, the Google glasses. And the education layer, I want you to imagine when these Google glasses come out at the end of this year and I see something and I now have the ability to learn the English word for that. Now, who do you think, that we have 2 billion new kids coming online over the next 15, between now and 2030, I believe it is 2030, no, 2040, sorry. Next 30 years, 2 billion more kids, 1 billion in Asia, 1 billion in Africa. Now, I'm of the opinion that 70, 60% of those kids are going to learn what language?
Well, I would say it's going to be 2 languages, probably Mandarin and English, huh?
Yeah, and it's not going to be Mandarin, my friend, because English is vastly easier to learn. So we have 450,000 specialized words, 5 times more than Shakespeare's time. Deep vocabularies in law, in medicine, in technology. And the Chinese use the English words when they get into the technical space. They're coming to the game late. But more importantly, and not to disparage my Chinese friends, but more importantly, the aspirations of the world are to create cultures that are not Chinese, they're not Indian, they are Western. Now, that's either European West or United States West, right?
Right.
And so that's why our entertainment is going to continue to be the entertainment that dominates the space. Bollywood makes twice as many movies as Hollywood, but those movies don't go everywhere. Those don't they don't create the avatar, because the memes that are being pushed by those countries are designed to keep those countries together. And India is the world's largest democracy, and all the Bollywood memes are really designed to keep the Indians from falling into 50 different countries, right? And the memes that are pushed in China are, again, designed to make economic progress and keep politics off the table, because they don't want to do the post-Soviet meltdown themselves. They want to get as quickly as possible to the chicken in every pot. And then, 10, 15 years from now, they liberalize the way so many of the other Asian democracies have, right? So does that mean that, am I making a politically insensitive statement that Western culture is, 20, 30 years ahead of the rest of the culture of the world? Yes, I am. Okay, I believe that. I believe that most democracies in the world want not just the material things that we have, but they want the kinds of legal codes that we have, which are, 2 or 3 times deeper than many of these other countries, with the kinds of personal freedoms and protections. And they want kids that think that they can change the world with their next new innovation, the way many of our kids do, right? So that kind of culture, we're going to continue to dominate, even though we have all the problems that we do on the political side, as we know. And I want you to imagine the thing that's driving China's rise right now are all these kids. in these poor rural areas, right? And you know, the GDP growth in those towns is like 3% a year. The GDP growth in China cities is 20% a year. So China averages up to 9% because it's got all these hungry kids coming in from these very underemployable environments, right?
Right.
So you think of the bottom 3 billion today. They're all going to have iPhone. They're all going to have phones with a conversational interface in the next 2, 3, 4 years, and they're going to have Google glasses. They can actually get things that they see interpreted for them, so they can learn language. They can learn useful math, simple quantitation, simple analytical skills, simple critical thinking skills, all through these platforms, right? These AR platforms. Now, global English is going to be, as soon as that becomes free, the kinds of environment we see, Rosetta Stone, you know, the reason Rosetta Stone beats everything else out there is because you're learning visually. So you're actually on a bus, right? Seeing all of the things on the bus or on a train. And so if you're 80% of our brain works visually, so you need these visual, it's like an immersion program, right? Well, that kind of thing is going to be doable when someone's wearing AR glasses and they recognize a visual thing, and then, you know, Google or whoever's central processors, you want the English word for that. But the exciting thing is going to be the gamification layer that comes on top of that and the certification layers, because LinkedIn and all these other jobs type platforms, they're going to create their own, once you have a conversational interface, they're going to create their own certification systems to say that this person can handle this particular thing. Not only do they have good enough English, but now we can plug them in as call center operators anywhere in the world for any English-speaking business. But if they learn a particular skill and they get rated up to a certain level, now we can plug those kids into Odesk or GitHub or Monster.com or Dice or whoever's human resources platform basically will give out piecework to that kid in any English-speaking country.
Jobster.com. I have to throw that one in real fast. Sorry,
thank you, Jobster.
Yeah.
So think of the power of all of those underemployed kids all learning English over the next 15 years, and you start to see the kinds of accelerations the conversational interface can give us, and the way that we can route around the damage of our educational institutions, because they're just as bad as the political systems. You spend too much time thinking about those, unless you're an educator. If you're an educator in that space, you know, go ahead, start a charter school, figure out some cool new way to take over a piece of the system. But the truth is that system is so politicized, it's so hard to make any kinds of change, particularly anything below 10th grade, right? The reality is you got to route around the damage like the Internet. You're going to have to create something on the Internet that's what we, Tom Prey calls teacherless education, right? You got to get to a space where the kids are learning just in time all the skills that they need, and they're being plugged in. You know, I want you to remember 1997 and 1999. It was a very magical time, wasn't it? Or actually, right up to April 2000. April. For those who lived through it,
there's a sharp drop off there, right?
Yeah. Those who lived through it remember that era, right? And all the Aeron shares were for all those .coms were out on the curb being sold, at, you know, in May 2000, right? Because they'd all ran out of money. But from 97 to April 2000, people got smart and realized a Microsoft certified system engineer credential was worth more than a bachelor's degree. And we're talking about a world now where people are wising up and realizing, you know, $80,000 in college debt for this, you know, factory model education isn't really going to give me the job that I need. I need something better. So I need just-in-time certification in all these areas. Well, I'm here to tell you that when the conversational interface hits, very shortly afterwards, the leading social networks and the gamification layer, all the games these kids will be playing, which of course we'll be producing, the entertainment, you know, the entertainment, edutainment of the future is going to be one of our primary exports. All those kids, all the data, like Ender Wiggin, you know, playing Ender's Game, all the data on the character of those kids, their motivation, their skills, that you're going to be able to drop in to those platforms of the future to find the very best kids. You know, today we're seeing weak examples like where do you think the top call center work is in the United, in the world is now? Who just beat India?
Gosh, I don't know. There's big ones in the Philippines.
I was going to say India, but it's not India.
Yeah, and so what happened? So people got smart, and they realized these Philippine kids are going to stick longer into call centers. First, they realize they speak English just as well, right? And second, they're going to stay a year or two longer because their alternative employment is less. There's less of it available. It's less developed. And, you know, who's going to beat the call center, you know, and the tech support and all of the specialty, you know, coding and all the other, video editing and all the other skills that these kids will be doing, you know, in this internet TV future that we're heading to? It's going to be kids in these even hungrier places. The African kids are going to come online, you know, within 10 years. And even they, you know, I mean, that you can't get teachers to go to these countries, right? So they absolutely need a teacherless education revolution. And, you know, these are the kinds of things that are going to deliver it. And
all right, John, we've got about 4 minutes left.
Yep.
Can we touch, any of these other changes you want to touch on before we, the show
sure.
will sort of hang up on us?
Give you the outline of the rest of them. So social technologies,
okay.
values maps, symbiont networks, the conversational web are going to drive learning and productivity, diversity and activism. We didn't get a chance to even get to that. Economic technologies, you know, where is the economic and productivity platforms of the future go? I think I've given you a piece of that when we talked about these human resources hubs and the education hubs that are coming. Political technologies. And there's a whole number of those. As we get more networked, we eventually get a lot more activism, and I think it's going to be more exciting on the local scale first. We're going to figure out ways people will see that they can take over their local environments much easier, and then they'll get empowered to start taking over things on the state and then eventually the government level, the federal levels.
Interesting. You can talk about
redemocratizing them.
So many of these other tech, I mean, when you think about it, right, the printing press was the great political technology of its day, right? TV is a great political technology. The internet itself has become this really powerful political technology. And I know you're talking about technologies designed specifically for that, but I think it's important to note that the change is occurring not just because there's new technologies developed for that, but because of all the other changes you're talking about that are occurring as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're absolutely right. It's the context for all this stuff that really is so important, and that's why it's fun for us to keep, you know, jabbering about this stuff, because we'll start eventually figuring out what are the key drivers. And you know, I think we're basically saying, or at least I am, that platform is really the most important one right now. That we're just on the edge of a whole new platform that's going to empower a whole bunch of different things to happen. I guess the last three that we didn't discuss are security technologies. The world, kind of a global technological immune system coming, and what that would look like, health technologies, and cognitive technologies, how we change as our conversational interface and our cyber twins begin to reshape our conception of who we are. So I'm just going to leave it at those, and then maybe there's a few things in the chat room that we could discuss in the last minute or two. Is there anything that came up from our survey that people wanted to? Any problems or questions?
Speaking of financial technologies, one question that came up, and this will have to be our final topic, was that is it true that Canada is looking at adopting something along the lines of Bitcoin in place of their current currency, or in addition to? Do you know anything about that?
I don't, and you know, I'm kind of a bit of a skeptic on all those things. I think that those things are going to be—they're going to be like frequent flyer miles or Ithaca hours. You know, these local scripts that emerge, and they're going to work a little bit, but they're going to be counterfeited, and they're going to be hard to get people to get trust on them, and they're not going to be so convertible. And if they start to get convertible, then the government's going to come in and regulate them like a bank, because there is nobody more powerful on the planet than the global financial empire. It's not any government that you could dream or I can dream up It's the global financial banking and financial services industries. That's where all the power and all the innovation is right now. On the leading edge of these kind of economic political platforms, and the only thing to be powerful enough to put those guys back in a cage is what we talked about in our last discussion. You know, a cyber twin that basically is advising you on how to spend your money and your votes, and basically put those guys back, make them more transparent, make them more accountable again. In the meantime, I think we're going to see lots of these things people get excited about. We'll lose some real financial innovations like Kickstarter, like the Jumpstart Our Business Startups Bill, the Jobs Bill, right? We'll see crowdfunding emerge, and we'll see more of these accelerators and things like that. There will be some alternative currencies, but I'm not really that excited about them. I don't think they play a huge role. Sure, they make people play virtual games more. That's kind of cool because it gets them more into these. And as those virtual games become the serious games we talked about, where you can get the kind of the Andrew Wiggins style education playing these games, because there's a long tail of all the serious games. But I don't think we get to a world where there's really good serious games being created until the game production technologies lower the costs of making games a lot. That's easily 5 or more years away. So in the meantime, we're going to see a lot more documentaries, a lot more video that's produced that's real nonfiction video. But the game technologies don't get to that scale for a little while longer, I think, because it's still too hard to make a serious game. And the number of people that will want to play your serious game is always going to be a very narrow fraction, just like the number of people that are going to want to watch a documentary movie. But once you get a documentary movie down to $100,000, you got all these people out there now making their money back, creating all these cool documentaries and selling them on Netflix, for crying out loud. They don't even have internet television yet. But just on Netflix and Amazon, these guys, these philanthropists, are making their money back. And so now we're seeing all this cool nonfiction video. And YouTube hasn't even blown up yet, right? The big play for internet television, which is happening this year, Microsoft and the three-way war between Microsoft and Apple and Google, that hasn't even happened yet. Everyone's just still rumbling about it, right? In that platform, we're going to see real awesome educational video blow up, and then the educational games blow up probably 3 or 4 years after that.
Going to be huge. Well, John, that does it in terms of time. I'll tell you what, let's plan on this. Over any period of time you want to do it, let's have you back on and let's take each one of these and do a whole show on each. I'm not saying we'll do that over the next month, but over the next year or whatever works out with your schedule, I think we could easily spend an hour talking about each item on this list.
It would be a whole lot of fun. Let's talk about what would be the value there for you guys, and you know, what we could do in terms of how this would be helpful for the community. You know, how would we all network? What would be the outcome? I think we want to have some measurable outcomes of this if we did. We want to see more people signing up for your YouTube feed or something like that. And we'd want to make that part of doing this. You know, in other words, some what we call direct actions that everyone who's listening can do that is a measurable, simple, easy thing, price of a cup of coffee or, you know, half an hour's time or less. And if we can come up with some things like that, that we pair to these, then I'd be interested, because then we can actually say, oh, look, we're having a measurable impact here. And if not, maybe we'll just, you know, do this the way we've been doing it, you know, get together once a year or something like that. But I think it's a fun idea, and I'd love to chat with you more about, you know, how we could make these kind of conversations make people feel more empowered, you know, in terms of the direct actions that they can take as a result of them.
All right. Well, I'll tell you, we'll put our heads together and we'll come up with Stephen and I'll talk about this. We'll talk with our regular listeners, and we'll come up with a proposal for you, and we'll see if it makes sense. John, it's always a great pleasure having you with us, and I'm looking forward to seeing you tomorrow night, bud.
Yeah, me too, bud. Yeah, thanks everyone, and have a great evening.
All right, thank you, Stephen. What's our music tonight?
The music tonight is Don't Let Go by Rich Oates, a young guy who's just getting started. Sounds great, and I've listened to all his stuff here, and looking forward to playing more of his stuff as we go forward. So Don't Let Go by Rich Oates.
Rich Oates plays Don't Let Go. Well, thank you for putting that together. Thanks, everyone, for listening. The only ones who can hear us now are those who've listened via archive, so thanks for being with us on Fast Forward Radio. We'll be back again next week at the regular time. Look forward to being with you all then, and until next time, live to see it.
And it's getting really hard to choose. When winter comes a-calling and it's coming all too soon for you. And when she calls me down,